Tonight on Exposé, media loyal to the Zionists exposed its hypocrisy to the world by giving excuses for the Israeli entity aggression on the Iranian consulate in Damascus. Similarly, digital media opted to maneuver around Zionist Israel's intentional provocation to Iran to a point that some newspapers even acquitted Zionists of their utter disregard of international law. And a timeline of some of the major assassinations in Iran reportedly carried out by Zionist Israel since 2010. Welcome to Exposé, the show that leaves no stone unturned. It is hard to say which was more significant, who was assassinated or where. It was a serious escalation in the long confrontation between Zionist Israel and the Islamic Republic of Iran, where Zionists hit a target that should have been off limits under international norms. Broadcast media has an extravaganza coverage over this. Let us hear it all from Fuad Itayim, our broadcast expert in Fake News Exposé. On April 1, an Israeli entity military aircraft launched a missile strike on the Iranian embassy and consulate located in the Syrian capital of Damascus. As a result of the vicious attack, 7 Iranian military personnel, 3 Syrian civilians, and 1 Lebanese civilian were murdered. General Mohammad Zahiri of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps was martyred in the Israeli assault on the Iranian consulate. So why did Zionist Israel cross a red line by bombing the Iranian embassy in Syria, violating international law? Is the purpose of the attack to provoke Iran into a war? Here is Fuad Itayim, our broadcast media expert, with the answers.
Thank you, Marwa. So the main goal of the attack was basically to destroy the consulate and assassinate a general in the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, Mohammad Zahiri. But as the Zionists and their American patrons assassinated General Qasem Soleimani in Baghdad in 2020, this happened off of the battlefield in the same way that Soleimani was assassinated, marking a serious escalation. So definitely they're trying some kind of provocation. And these 7 Iranian military personnel being assassinated was obviously and blatantly a cowardly move.
Yeah.
There is no other way to describe it, and it was a severe violation of international law and of international law's protections for diplomatic missions and diplomatic offices. The Zionists wanted to get rid of General Mohammad Zahiri, who was considered a very important figure in the resistance axis and connecting Iran with resistance factions across the region, especially Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement. By doing this, Israel wanted to reduce the influence of the alliance and the coordination between the resistance factions. But of course, it has miscalculated and has failed once again.
Definitely.
So mainstream media spoke widely about this news, explaining how this has potentially catastrophic consequences on everyone, everywhere. Let's start with CNBC, which brought in an analyst to explain how the attack was a grave rule-breaking mistake.
Well, I think Israel's attack on the Iranian consulate building in Damascus is a significant change in the rules of engagement, the implicit rules of engagement that have, in a sense, governed the confrontation and the shadow war between Iran and Israel. This is the first attack of its kind, a direct, ostentatious Israeli strike on an Iranian diplomatic mission. Now, on one level, it's an attempt by Israel, obviously, to impose greater costs on Iran for supporting armed non-state actors in the region, such as Hezbollah, the Houthis, the Palestinian Jihad, Hamas, and others that are engaged directly or indirectly in conflict with Israel. But I think there's a wider political effect that Israel is trying to achieve here. And I think it's an attempt to shift the narrative from being a war with Hamas and the Palestinians to being a war against Iran.
A very important and frankly rare point made on a pro-Israeli channel like CNBC, where the analyst that they bring on, Hassan al-Hassan, perfectly explains why the Zionists attempted such a risky move. So Hassan explains that the reason is the constant and unwavering political, military, and financial support given by Iran to the resistance factions across the region, namely Hamas, Hezbollah, and Yemen's Ansar Allah, who have opened direct and effective fronts against Israel in this war. So CNBC actually gives the analyst a platform to accuse Israel of isolating itself, of course, after this global criticism campaign that Israel is facing and has put itself through because of the genocide it's waging against the Palestinians in Gaza. Mm-hmm. So, fair enough.
That's a first. Let's see how it happened.
And I think Israel has sees itself as being increasingly isolated. We've seen the U.S. choose not to veto a U.N. Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire last week. We've seen increasingly vocal U.S. criticism of Israel's conduct in this war. And I think achieving the shift in narrative, turning this into a confrontation primarily against Iran, rather than simply a conflict with Hamas, I think is an attempt by Israel to bring the U.S. on board and to change the narrative.
I completely hear what he's saying, because Zionist Israel has always went through that door of basically provoking Iran in the region every time they have a chance. But this time it is really scary, and the escalation might be coming.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Now we have DW, which is famously known for blindly defending Israel and propagating lies on its behalf.
I have no doubt.
Especially the hoax of the beheaded babies and the raped women on October 7th, which turned out to be a scandalous lie and was exposed as such. DW actually questioned the legitimacy of the Zionist strike on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, but made sure, of course, to bring on a guest who was down to his bones Zionist and who just brushed off the UN's condemnation of the illegitimate attack and accused Iran of initiating it by taking over the Zionist embassy in Tehran after the revolution, which is like something that happened 45 years ago.
Oh, my God. So, oh, my God. It's not even surprising to see that they could ask a question but await for such a hypocritical answer. I'm interested to see that.
Listen to this, Marwa, and tell me what you think.
I'll tell you.
Are diplomatic strikes or sites like the Iranian consulate in Damascus, are they legitimate targets for attack?
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you. It's an excellent question, and one whose spirit could be answered by the UN clip you had just played about safeguarding the relative immunity of all sorts of diplomatic and consular facilities. There's only one major problem or caveat or footnote to that, which is that the government of the Islamic Republic commenced its hostility 45 years ago nearly with the outside world by literally violating that diplomatic immunity and creating this sense of hostility and using its embassies and missions and cultural centers and consular offices abroad as fronts for terrorism or recruitment or kidnapping. And what you've seen most importantly is that Iran used the civil war in Syria, the fractious, chaotic situation there, to not only support the murderous Assad regime, but to use that situation to function as a bridgehead into Lebanon to create yet another front against Israel. So if there's anyone here violating international norms and rules, there is a linear line between cause and effect that needs to be assessed first.
I cannot believe that man. Literally looking at the dead people in the streets, the destruction of the consulate, and saying, oh, it's Iran's typical pro-genocidal humans. This is what they see. They see their own massacres committed, and they say, oh, it's because of you. I'm killing you for your own benefit. That's something that we usually say in Arabic as a matter of a joke, but this is not a joke. This is very serious. But the way that they present themselves to the world as if that what they are doing is something moral and should be commended by everyone instead of condemned is out of this world. This is so infuriating, but at the same time, I think that the global opinion is well aware of how this manipulation is happening, and they're not going to fall for it.
Of course, and I mean, hopefully the tide continues to turn with the public opinion. I completely see where you're coming from, Marwa. I don't think we can possibly describe how outrageous this was and how much of a breach of international law this Zionist attack was. It's hard to think of a similar scenario unfolding on any other consulate of any other country. As you can imagine, the response from the Islamic Republic has been complete outrage. So we know one thing for sure, the retaliation is coming. Mm-hmm. We heard this from Iranian officials, we heard this from Hezbollah leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, and we know that there's no other choice. I mean, Iran has been very wise, Iran has been very restrained, and mm-hmm. As the Islamic Republic ambassador at the UN said after the strike, there is only so much patience one can exercise.
Yeah, definitely.
So such and a destructive... Yeah.
I think that the strategic patience of Iran is something to admire, but at the same time, I do believe that they themselves feel that they are out of this patience and definitely will make sure that a proper retaliation will happen against this genocidal
such
entity.
A strike can only warrant a response.
Definitely. Thank you very much, Fuad, for
your
analysis for this very important segment of our show. Now, ladies and gents, stay tuned because now we move on to digital mainstream media. The targeting of diplomatic personnel from a foreign country within the borders of another sovereign nation violates established international legal standards. The potential repercussions of such actions are certainly expected to be grave. However, many mainstream digital media platforms opted to debate whether it's okay to bomb embassies in other countries or not. Here is our digital media expert Julia Qasim with more on this matter.
Thanks, Marwa. Well, it's intriguing to watch an escalation that could only be interpreted as a direct provocation to Iran was debated and at some points acquitted by digital mainstream media. Mm-hmm. So by targeting the Iranian embassy in Damascus, which is actually Iranian territory under international law, Israel has now backed itself into a corner, proving yet again that it operates outside of international law while being backed and receiving the implicit support of the so-called international community.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm pretty sure that we have a lot to talk about, especially starting maybe with one of the major publications in the United States of America. How did they talk or how did they publish in the aftermath of this blatant attack on Iran?
Well, let's start with the New York Times, which claimed that, quote, Israel can likely argue that its actions did not violate international law's protections for diplomatic missions. Despite the fact that diplomatic premises have been afforded special protections by international law and that attacks on diplomatic compounds carry particular weight both in law and in popular imagination, the New York Times still had the audacity to print a piece by Amanda Taub entitled, Israel Bombed an Iranian Embassy Complex. Is that allowed? So in this piece, Amanda argues that the experts she spoke with claimed Israel considers its actions that did not violate international laws mm-hmm. protections for
no
diplomatic
surprise
missions.
There.
Of course,
mm-hmm.
Israel's own version of international law. Mm-hmm. So here's allegedly why. The New York Times audaciously claimed that Iran was using the consulate for criminal and military purposes, writing, but while those rules of diplomatic relations are a bedrock principle of international law, they actually have little force in the case of the Damascus bombing, experts say, because they only refer to the responsibilities of the receiving state, in this case Syria, and say nothing about attacks by a third state on foreign territory.
Mm-hmm.
Then to add a cherry on top of this absolute farce, R.L. Sari, a professor of international law at Exeter University in the United Kingdom, was quoted saying the following, Israel is a third state and not bound by the law of diplomatic relations with regard to Iran's embassy in Syria.
Wow.
So imagine this so-called professor of international law claimed that receiving states have an obligation to protect embassies from attacks like that of what Israel committed, which theoretically, according to this professor, would mean that Syria had an obligation to protect the Iranian embassy if it could. However, it's not clear what protective steps it could have taken in this case.
Especially against an Israeli entity missile.
Right. So Marwa, the New York Times is blaming Syria for the Israeli war jets that struck the Iranian consulate in Damascus.
Wow.
Ultimate victim blaming. I mean,
definitely.
Is there anything more insulting in the framework of international law or even journalism?
Mm-hmm.
So that the country under attack is to be blamed for the attack of another country's embassy on its soil conducted by a third aggressive entity. I mean, just wow, really.
Definitely. I see where you're coming from.
Yeah. So The Economist had a slightly different approach than that of the New York Times, where it reported that what Israel did was a dangerous game in a region already at war.
Mm-hmm.
So in a piece published one day after the Zionist Israeli strike on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, The Economist wrote, if the mere presence of military men was enough to override it, some of Israel's own embassies would be legitimate targets too. Even Saudi Arabia, a longtime rival of Iran, was quick to denounce the strike, although it did not name Israel for its condemnation.
Mm-hmm.
So The Economist then reminded its readers that after the assassination of Al-Quds Force Commander, martyr General Qasem Soleimani, Iran made do with firing a barrage of ballistic missiles at two U.S. occupation bases in Iraq, the largest such Iranian retaliatory attack to date. So The Economist wrote, there may be more domestic pressure to respond this time. Iran has weathered months of Israeli attacks, and by striking a consular building, Israel has now, in effect, bombed Iranian soil. So it's worth noting, Marwa, that following the Zionist attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, American officials made it known publicly that they had no advanced knowledge of the attack, a message they also passed to intermediaries, to their Iranian counterparts in a show of de-escalation, in hopes that the Iranian retaliation won't include American bases or interest in West Asia.
So they just said, it wasn't me, I didn't know.
Yeah, I mean, they're still traumatized from the Ayn al-Assad bombings in 2020.
Imagine.
So, which is yet to be seen whether or not it'll basically be believed by the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Well, thank you very much, our mainstream media expert, Ms. Julia Qasim, for this, showing us how really these publications are hypocritical all the time. And I think people have been noticing this for the past at least 6 months. And I think that they already know that this is not the truth, and they should not believe what these major publications write. Thank you very much for your time
thank
and your
you.
Contribution. Now, ladies and gents, we move on to social media expose. In the wake of the Zionist attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, social media users swiftly condemned the act as a violation of international law. Users from all across the world voiced their support for an Iranian decisive action, asserting that Iran reserves the legal and inalienable right to respond decisively to this terrorist attack. Let us see what our social media expert Sima Itayim has for us on the issue. Floor is yours, dear Sima.
Thanks, Marwa, for having me as usual. So social media users were quick to offer their insights on what the potential consequences of what this strike on Iran's sovereignty would look like, with the majority of them predicting an all-out war in the region. And then there were others who emphasized the importance of Iran appealing to the UN, thinking that, you know, this way Iran would be legitimizing its retaliatory strikes internationally. And then there were others who thought, no, Iran should turn its back on the international community and do as Israel does, exactly, and, you know, retaliate, not wait for affirmation from anyone. So let's start with a very eloquent post by an account I enjoy, Caitlin Johnstone, who wrote on X, "In the span of just a few hours, we learned that Israel committed a horrific massacre at Al-Shifa Hospital, struck an Iranian consulate in Syria, killing multiple Iranian military officers, and killed a vehicle full of international aid workers in an airstrike. This murderous regime is out of control." So Caitlin then shared a video of Tim Foley, who was narrating Caitlin's article about this major escalation. So let's hear a part of that.
Okay.
"Israel keeps getting more murderous. Notes from the edge of the narrative matrix. In the span of just a few hours, we learned that Israel committed a horrific massacre at Al-Shifa Hospital, struck an Iranian consulate in Syria, killing multiple Iranian military officers, and killed a vehicle full of international aid workers in an airstrike. This murderous regime is out of control."
So next we have a post by Arno Bertrand, who we've talked about before on this show. He shared screenshots from a transcript of a Q&A session in the Department of Defense right after Israel targeted the Iranian consulate in Damascus, saying, "So the Pentagon officially confirms it was Israel that destroyed the Iranian consulate in Damascus. Yet another sign, if need be, that we're in completely uncharted territory. Even during World War I and World War II, states knew that targeting embassies or consulates was off limits. There are no instances, none, of a state deliberately bombing an enemy's embassy during these wars. The fact Israel now does this, fully acknowledged by the U.S. and undoubtedly done with U.S. weaponry and approval, shows just how rogue and unhinged these countries have become, violating centuries-old cornerstone norms of international relations."
Amen to that.
And what's interesting is that people from all over the world were actually mourning the fallen Iranian martyrs. And they, you know, they went to, they approached Iranian social media users to offer their condolences. This is something that definitely, you know, bypasses the constant Western demonization of anything related to Iran. And I'm sure it was overlooked. For example, here we have a post by Gregory, who quoted a video from the funeral procession of the Iranian martyrs, offering his condolences. Gregory then posted the following: "I offer my sincere condolences to the families of the martyrs and to the people of Iran following the outrageous attack upon the Iranian state by an entirely deranged Israel as it bombed the Iranian consulate in Damascus." Mm-hmm. And then we saw more respects being paid on social media for this attack with Taqdis, mm-hmm. who posted on X, "Terrorist Israel is targeting embassies. In Syria, Israel attacked the Iranian embassy and killed 7 people. We express full solidarity with our Iranian brothers and sisters in fighting Israel's terrorism. Stay strong, Iran. Lots of prayers for Iran from Pakistan." Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Well, I can see how this majorly played against what Zionist Israel wanted or what Netanyahu was attempting to do. But it seems that he has forgotten that after 6 months of genocide on an entire population, the world no longer believe anything that he spews, and unlikely to what he believes, the world actually stands with Iran and is waiting on that retaliatory attack. Thank you very much for showing us what social media has said about this very dangerous escalation. Seema, thank you for being with
us.
Now, ladies and gents, we move on to Figures Exposé. Since 2010, Zionist Israel has reportedly conducted at least 24 operations, including assassinations, drone strikes, and cyber attacks on the Islamic Republic of Iran. The following is a timeline of some of the major assassinations in Iran reportedly carried out by Zionist Israel since 2010. Beginning with January 12, 2010, Mas'ud Ali Muhammadi, a physics professor at Tehran University, was martyred by a remote-controlled bomb planted on a motorcycle. Now, November 29, 2010, Professor Majid Shariari, a member of the nuclear engineering faculty at Shahid Beheshti University in Tehran, was martyred in his car on his way to work. His wife was wounded in the blast. Now, on January 11, 2012, Mustafa Ahmadi Roshan, a chemical engineering graduate, was martyred after 2 people on a motorbike placed a bomb on his car in northern Tehran. Now, in July 2, 2020, an explosion caused extensive damage to Iran's main nuclear enrichment site in Natanz. Now, in November 27, 2020, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a prominent nuclear scientist, was assassinated in a roadside attack about 40 miles east of Tehran. Israeli intelligence had long claimed that Fakhrizadeh was the father of Iran's nuclear program. Not to forget that Zionist Israel initiated cyber attacks several times, knocking out systems in Iran, whether directed at civilian targets or nuclear targets. Now let us move on to the most notable exposé voices for this week. Voices on social media, especially TikTok platform, were majorly condemning the Zionist audacity of targeting the Iranian consulate in Syria, while later on wailing about the fact that Iran will make Zionist Israel pay for what it did. TikTok users shared their views about the gravity of the potential repercussions to the latest Zionist risky move. Here is Samantha Ann on TikTok.
They are not a country to play cat and mouse with. They are not a country that you can just go in and bomb leaders and do whatever it is that you want. Basically, a declaration of war is what they did, and think that you can walk away unscathed without any type of retaliation or any type of revenge. I honestly don't think that Israel is going to be able to walk away from this completely unmarked. I think that this is going to be the start of something bigger. I think that it is quite possible that Iran is going to start to regroup and start planning a strategy against Israel that is going to change the way everything is happening in the Middle East now.
Appalachian Prepper is another voice for this week who raised the question of whether Zionist Israel committed this crime to drag the United States of America into a direct conflict with Iran.
But with Israel claiming responsibility for Monday's attack, this is a major escalation. With the Iranian Supreme Leader saying the Zionist regime will be punished by the hands of our brave men, we will make it regret this crime and others it has committed. Now, it appears that Iranians are holding the U.S. responsible for what Israel has done, just as much as the U.S. holds Iran responsible for what the Iraqi militias do. Now, retaliation in the form of a direct Iranian attack on Israel would invite a reciprocal attack on Iranian soil. And that has the possibility to drag the United States into a regional war.
Ladies and gents, with that, we conclude our exposé for tonight. Stay tuned for more eye-opening investigations on Exposé. The truth is just a revelation away.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. Please stay tuned.
یه صحنه رو نقل کنه میگه روز قیامت افرادی رو نامهشون رو دست راستشون میدن.
In the Holy Quran Surah Al-Inshiqaq Ayah 7 and 8 we read, then as for him who is given his record of deeds in his right hand, he will receive an easy reckoning. Also in Surah Talaq Ayah 8 we read, then we called it to a severe account and punished it with a dire punishment. Also in Surah Al-Kahf Ayah 105 we read, on the day of resurrection we will not give them any weight. The last ayah refers to those people who will enter the hellfire directly. There are also some people who will enter paradise without reckoning. In Ayah 40 of Surah Al-Ghafir, we read, whoever acts righteously, whether male or female, should he be faithful, such shall enter paradise, and they will be provided therein without a reckoning. So all in all, there are four groups of people when entering on the Day of Judgment. One group will have easy reckoning, and the other group, hard one. Yet another group will enter paradise without reckoning, and there is a group who will enter hellfire without reckoning. We must know, to which group do we belong?
Thank you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners of iRab English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qarati. To find out more about this program, please log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Indonesia's support for Palestine is deep-rooted. This support predates Indonesia's independence, so it cannot be shaken so easily by the Zionist propagandists. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, in the last few days, Israeli media has been reporting about Indonesia mulling normalization of relations with the Tel Aviv regime to fulfill the requirements for accession to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, and neoliberal market-based alliance countries. The news circulated at a dizzying pace on social media platforms and triggered a wide array of reactions from netizens worldwide, including in Indonesia. It wasn't something they were expecting. Indonesian Foreign Ministry was quick to deny the reports in a midnight statement, saying no such plan was in offing. The ministry spokesperson, Lalo Muhammad Iqbal, said, I affirm that, as of now, there are no plans to establish diplomatic relations with Israel, particularly given Israel's actions in Gaza. Most people in Indonesia reject and condemn any plan that leads to the normalization of ties between the two sides or Jakarta's recognition of the apartheid colonial entity. Several notes can be taken from this frenzy. First, the behavior of the Israeli media, citing anonymous sources to report on Indonesia's plans to normalize relations with Israel. It has happened several times in the last few years. Indonesian Foreign Ministry has always denied such reports. It again denied it, and then it was as if there was nothing more. There was no apology from the Israeli media, nor was there any criticism of the Israeli media from the Indonesian side. Indonesia's support for Palestine is deep-rooted. This support predates Indonesia's independence, so it cannot be shaken so easily by the Zionist propagandists. In 1934, when the Palestinians fought against the British, at that time Indonesia was still colonized by the Dutch, the clergy in Indonesia collected donations from the people to help Palestine. It is also recorded in history that a rich Palestinian businessman, Muhammad Ali Taher, in 1944 donated a large amount of money to the struggle for Indonesian independence. In history lessons at schools, our teachers often repeated the phrase Palestine was the first to recognize Indonesia's independence. What it actually meant is that after the proclamation of Indonesian independence on August 17, 1945, the Indonesian diplomat M. Zain Hasan came to Egypt to promote recognition of that independence. In order to support Hasan's efforts, a number of resistance figures in the Arab world based in Cairo founded Lajnatud Defain Indonesia on October 16, 1945, including General Saleh Har Pasha, Secretary General of the Arab League, and Abdurrahman Azam Pasha, Chairman of the Palestine Committee. The recommendation from the Lajna was a resolution to support the Republic of Indonesia and an appeal to all countries, especially Arab and Islamic countries, to recognize the new republic. After that, almost all the Arab countries recognized the Republic of Indonesia one by one. Apart from that, Indonesia initiated and hosted the Asia-Africa Conference from April 18th to 24th, 1955, the first conference of formerly colonized countries in the world whose main spirit was to liberate all the colonized people on Earth. Support for Palestinian independence was one of the dominant issues at this conference. Indonesia has a historical burden to maintain that spirit and fulfill its promise of independence for Palestine. The third point is, it needs to be acknowledged that there are indeed parties in Indonesia, both politicians and prominent figures, who are secretly establishing personal relations with Israel. Indonesia's decision to submit a membership application to the OECD, an organization controlled by Western capitalist countries, instead of joining a new economic power that is far more promising for shared prosperity, namely BRICS, shows the dominance of the West in Indonesia's economic posture. Membership in the OECD requires the consent of all members, including Israel. It is very possible that there are figures behind the scenes who are trying to normalize Indonesia-Israel for their interests, especially business interests. However, they never expressed their intentions openly because it would be tantamount to political suicide. No politician in Indonesia would dare to commit suicide at this time, when public sentiment is very strong in supporting Palestine and against Israel's genocidal crimes in Gaza. Thus, it can be concluded that the rumors of normalization were Israeli propaganda that took advantage of the tendencies of a few parties behind the scenes, but which immediately hit a wall of failure. The Indonesian people will not allow that normalization to happen, as Indonesia's first president, Sukarno, stated, "As long as the independence of the Palestinian people has not been handed over to the Palestinian people, the Indonesian people will always stand up to challenge Israeli colonialism."
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Chawit, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Let's talk about the same topic that, in fact, we started from, last episode, and that means enjoining the good and forbidding the evil, and some of the jurisprudential laws related to that, Sheikh Chawit. And let me start with this question. Is it permissible to neglect or ignore, let's say, enjoining the good and forbidding the evil for fear of losing one's job? For example, the head of an educational institution who deals with the university youth commits actions against the Sharia or paves the way for commission of sins in that particular place, while we fear of losing our job if we forbid him from this evil.
Well, as we discussed in one of the previous episodes, one of the conditions that must be fulfilled when enjoining the good is that one should be safe from any harm. And if you are not safe, that means actually Amr bil Ma'ruf and Nahy anil Munkar are not obligatory on you. So as a general rule, if the duty-bound person fears considerable harm for himself in enjoining the good and forbidding the evil, it will not be obligatory for him to engage in such a practice.
I see. Well, Sheikh Chawit, if the good is neglected and evil is common in some places, let's say in a market or in an academic environment, and the conditions for enjoining the good and forbidding evil are there, will one be relieved of performing this duty if one is single?
Well, when there is a case to enjoin the good and forbidding evil, and the required conditions are available, it is the Shari as well as social and human obligation of the mukallafs, the duty bound people, to do so. I mean, they should do whatever they can to stop the evil and promote what is called virtue. So such things as being, for example, married or unmarried, I think does not change the ruling. And of course, merely being unmarried does not exempt one from carrying out this obligation, which is obligatory on every individual who has attained puberty. Now, regardless of your age, regardless of the position you are, so if the conditions of fulfilling, of enjoining the good and forbidding evil are available, then you have to do it.
I see. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay tuned.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Chawit, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to enjoining the good and forbidding the evil. Sheikh Chawit, if one comes across evidence of sinful conducts, impropriety and insincerity of a person holding a powerful position, so that one fears his power and influence, Is it permissible to neglect enjoining the good and forbidding the evil in relation to that individual? Or is it obligatory for one to call that person to the good and forbid him, let's say, from evil, even one is afraid of that individual's harm?
Yeah. Well, if there's a reasonable and genuine fear of harm coming from that individual, which you described as someone who is powerful, who is, you know, threatening, so it will not be obligatory in such cases to enjoin the good and forbid the evil, because the condition is not met. One of the conditions is that one should be safe from any harm, and in this case, maybe the individual who enjoins the good and forbids the evil is not safe, because he puts himself in harm's way by enjoining someone who is very aggressive, who is very violent. So, of course, such a person is relieved of the obligation of Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahy anil Munkar. But meanwhile, it's not good for someone to neglect reminding and advising his brother in faith simply for fear of the position of the person who neglects the good, or that of the perpetrator of the evil, or for the mere likelihood of some harm inflicted by him. So if there's a chance, or maybe likelihood or probability, one should not take these seriously and into account stopping Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahy anil Munkar.
Sheikh Javid, don't you think that it also necessitates a kind of negotiation techniques, like or psychological, for example, techniques, so that we can somehow smooth talk,
yes,
to the person, and don't go, you know, hard or radical and cold turkey on the person, and we somehow don't be straightforward and frank when it comes to it, and could we use some indirect techniques,
you're right,
let's say, to somehow talk the person into doing something good and talk him out of doing something bad.
You're right.
Doesn't it necessitate that kind of technique?
I think you are very right, much right. Because in this time around, being very rigid and strict and, let's say, very much outspoken in terms of conveying that message of Islam, mm, and spreading virtue,
or convincing the person
it does not work, mm-hmm, you know. You can, as you rightly mentioned, you can act in an
indirectly
indirect way to draw his attention and to remind him of his duty to do what is good and to stay away from what is bad.
Like, I remember the story of Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein trying to teach that old person, mm, the senior citizen, how to make the correct or proper wuzu, right?
Yes, yes.
And they went up to the person and they asked him which one of us, in fact, makes proper wudu, you
sure,
know,
yeah,
without telling the old person directly that you're wrong in the way that you make the wudu, you know.
Good.
So this is
the indirect
technique, basically.
Of course, yeah.
All right.
For example, if you tell someone straight away, why don't you offer, it's haram that you don't offer your prayers, mm, and it's a great sin to, he will take offense, and he,
yes,
he will react.
Take guards and,
yeah,
reactions.
Reaction
your
will
things.
Be, yeah. It will have no effect. Rather, he will further get, you know, distanced from the religion.
So taking the right tone and discourse is very necessary,
necessary.
Like the knowledge that you talked about in one of the previous episodes about the religious issues. If you don't know the knowledge,
yes,
if you don't know you know, the correct things, the sins or whatever the good deeds, then how can you enjoin somebody to the good or forbid him from evil?
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
اللهم صل على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and shortly with our guest speaker. We are still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to enjoining the good and forbidding the evil is Sheikh Javid. Sheikh, at times forbidding a sinner creates negative feelings against Islam due to that individual's ignorance of Islamic duties and rules. On the other hand, if we leave that person alone, it will prepare the ground for others to corrupt the environment and commit sins. So what's the duty, what's our duty in this regard?
Well, enjoining the good and forbidding evil, when the conditions are available, are considered public religious duties.
Right.
For sake of safeguarding Islamic laws and social health. So it is a collective duty, and every individual should in his own turn fulfill this duty, because everybody needs to contribute to the social health in one way or the other.
Right.
Well, the mere suspicion that it might, you know, create negative feelings against Islam in some individuals does not actually justify the negligence of such an extremely crucial duty.
Sheikh Javid, if those assigned by the government to prevent corruption do not accomplish their duty well, is it permissible for people to take action or to take charge of this duty themselves?
Well, it's not permissible for other people to interfere with the affairs assigned to judicial authority, or security personnel, because they have to do their jobs. Intervening or interfering in the affairs of those people who have, for which there are certain people responsible, is not okay, because it will create further chaos and lawlessness. So there is no objection to enjoining the good and forbidding evil when carried out with due observance of the limits and conditions. So we did talk about the limits and conditions. So conditions must fulfill. One of which is, of course, that one should it should have the necessary effect. It should not have the negative consequences for the individual. And then if all of these conditions are fulfilled, then one can go ahead. And of course, in judicial matters, one should not take the law into his hand, arresting people,
that would cause
beating
mayhem
them.
And yeah. chaos in
You're
the
right.
society, right?
Beating them, imprisoning them, jailing them, and lashing them, that's not okay.
Yes.
And this practice is not endorsed by Islam and the Islamic Sharia and the scholars, the Shi'ite scholars. I'm not talking about the scholars from, let's say, other branches of faith.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, as the host of this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We bid you farewell. Keep us in your du'as. And thank you for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم ملجا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.